This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, this is beautiful Clearwater, Florida. It is so wonderful here. The weather is beautiful, and I know so many of you are suffering up north. But I just want to start the program. My very special guest today is Christine Hanna, and we're going to be talking to her about her wonderful new book, The Four Winds, and I'm just waiting for her to call in. Why don't we play the book buzz while we wait? Okay, well, that's okay. I'll just talk for a little while. We'll play the book buzz. I have a special book buzz, a February book buzz from Devon Miller. We'll play it at the end of the program because he is just, I am so thrilled with this young man. He came on the program and because he has written a series called Mr. Tickety Talk Clock, and it's just wonderful, wonderful. Okay. All right. We're going to play his book buzz.
Hey, everyone. This is Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety Talk Clock children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. It's that time of year. It's February, and that means love is in the air, and something that I myself love to do is draw. And that's what some of you guys are going to find yourself doing after reading this new book, Borders, written by children's literature enthusiast Chris Tomasi. In Chris's first published book, it's a book that asks the question, if kids were in charge of making the map of their country and or world, what would it look like? How would our world be redesigned? In an effort of attempting to understand the world we live in, Chris aims to inspire kids to reimagine our world for the better. Illustrated by Mark Breyer, the book encourages kids to go ahead, pick up some paper and pen, and draw the world as they imagine it. As a kid at heart who loves to draw, I think you'll find me drawing the world the way I imagine it too. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
Okay. Now, isn't he marvelous? He is just a wonderful, wonderful young man. And I am so thrilled that he's joined us here on Joy on Paper. And every month he's going to come with another selection for us. So I get this excitement for an author when I recognize somebody really, really great. And that's what I recognize with Devon. In just a minute, the very first time when he walked in the studio, and actually he was my first guest here, sort of after we thought that the pandemic was over, and it wasn't. But we are really, so excited that he's part of our Joy on Paper family now. And I am just waiting. Hold on, I'm just trying to call somebody here on my phone while I'm talking because I need to find out where.
You want to go to break?
Yeah, let's take a little break and then we'll see where my call is coming in from.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with a very, very special guest today. She sets the gold standard for women's authors. Well, I think she sets a gold standard for any author, because it is often that a publisher is ready to just run with 1.5 million books right out. Out of the gate. And with Kristen Hanna, we really have the gold standard here. Hi, Christine.
Hi, how are you? It's nice to be on the show.
Well, it's great to talk to you. And as I said, you are the gold standard now. I think that's what we have to call you. And since you live up in Alaska, or, you know, and you've been involved with Alaska so much, I think that's a fitting crown for you, huh?
Yes, I'm an overnight success after 30 years, so it's really fun.
Well, you got there, that's for sure. And I know that every female author says, I want to be like that. She wrote The Nightingale. She wrote The Nightingale. I say, yeah, oh, she wrote The Nightingale. When I announced that I was having you on the program, I got emails from so many of your fans. They wrote to me and they said, "Oh, it's just so exciting! How can you stand it? You get to talk to her." I get to talk to her. I said, "Well, you know, you could get to talk to her too if you could go to wherever she does a book signing." Oh my goodness, she's not doing any book signings.
Yes, the New World Order. Now we're doing virtual book events, which are actually really, really fun.
Yeah, but they're not as much fun. Really, that it's so much fun when fans get to see the author and actually get to ask their own questions, because you know, and so it was funny when I put up the notice and then, you know, I said you were going to be on today, they're like, oh my gosh, how can you, it is so exciting. And of course the new book, 1.5 million you pre-sold this, like, your publisher is so happy. I just like, gosh. And your publisher, everybody, and the new book is called The Four Winds, and it is quite an amazing story, a very American story. And as we know, a book is written long before it comes out, and so that it would come out at this time is pretty interesting.
Yeah, it surprises me, you know, how relevant it turns out to be. You know, when you set out to write about the Great Depression, you don't expect that, you know, when it comes out in 2021, it will feel of the moment. But, you know, that's the situation we find ourselves in now. And I think that the great thing about the book, and what really makes me happy about it, given its relevance, is that it's ultimately such a message of hope, you know, a reminder of how resilient we are as Americans, and that we have lived through hard times before, and we will definitely get through these again.
Wow. Yeah, and it is a book of hope. And I was wondering, you know, authors always work very hard on that opening and, you know, working on getting just the right tone and setting the right tone. And, you know, you have a very short prologue. And I was wondering, how long did it come to, or did that just come to you right out, sort of the minute you sat down when you started this book? Do you want to read that first line, or should I read it, or do you?
Sure, you go ahead and read it. I don't have it with me at the second.
Hope is a coin I carry, an American penny, given to me by a man I came to love. There were times in my journey when it felt as if that penny and the hope it represented were the only things that kept me going. Well, you know, you get tears in your eyes just reading that. And it's a great start for this book.
Thank you. And I did work really hard on it, and it didn't come to me, you know, right when I sat down. It actually probably came two and a half years in. And, you know, when I realized that that the story was really, you know, this quintessential American story, and it begins with immigrants coming over here to follow the American dream, and then, you know, a second generation having that American dream upset by the Great Depression. And an American penny just seemed like this beautiful talisman of hope and something that this family would carry with them and pass on.
Well, I found it very poignant, and I found it very relevant to something that I do. I throw new pennies on the ground. I deliberately do it. It came about years ago when I found a penny, and somebody said, you know, that's a lucky penny. And I held on to that penny for, I don't know, years. And that's when I was young. And then I moved overseas, and I don't know, I lost that penny. But then I thought after that, and when I came back to America after living overseas for so long, it is funny how that penny, that new copper penny, when you look at it, it really makes it. There are two things that really thrilled me when I came back to America. Milk. A really good glass of milk, because I
nice and cold.
Oh yeah, I lived in all sorts of weird places, and no, there was never a proper glass of milk. And then the new a new shiny penny, because when I came home to America, I mean, I had to get all American money, and I loved it. American money. I just, there's not in Europe. You and the Middle East, you'd have you know, dollars. They'd have dollars, but they didn't have coins, of course. And I love those pennies, and I drop them on to this day. I'll just toss a few.
Oh, I love that story. I mean, that's perfect. It's like, you know, maybe that's what someone did for the Martinellis back in Sicily. That's how they found their penny.
Exactly, because I like to imagine that, you know, a kid will be going, his mom will be taking him back to the car, and he'll say, oh, look, there's a penny. And she'll say, oh, yeah, that's a lucky penny, because somebody said that to me. So, and this quote of yours, this is going to be used on, I don't know how many things people are going to be putting this on.
I hope so. That would be great.
Well, it is a start. You know, I never know what to say about a book when I don't want people to know about what's going to happen in a book. You know, you on the one hand, you want to tell them the story. It's this wonderful story about Elsa, Elsinore. It's a real name. You have some interesting real names there, but she's known as Elsa. And in a way, I love that reveal that I didn't know anything that was going to happen. And I'll tell you, at the beginning, when people are saying, well, I will tell this much. People are saying terrible things to her. I was so angry at that point. It was, I thought, how did she write this? How did you write these words that people said nasty things to her? But people do say nasty things to children, and it's just heartbreaking.
It always is. And I think, you know, one of the great things about fiction, and especially historical fiction, is, you know, you can kind of, from a distance, comment on how we treat each other and the effects that has on people. And I always think it's, you know, important to remind people that you never know what someone else is going through. And, you know, the old kindergarten lesson, be kind. And it's a lesson that we can learn in our country right now, actually.
Well, never having experienced anything like that. I've only one time heard a mother say something nasty to her son in front of me. I mean, I just can't, you know, like, oh, you're stupid or something. I don't think anyone would dare to say something like that in front of me. Actually, I have such a personality that if a mother ever was, you know, to take off on her kid, I would step right in there. So nobody ever says, but people do say, and mothers say terrible things to their children sometimes. And I hope anybody who reads this will be so touched by it. They'll say, I will never, ever say anything like that when I have a child.
It's so interesting, too, because, you know, one of the themes of the book is right or wrong, you know, how much the things your parents say to you form your self-opinion and your self-esteem, and how difficult it is to sort of rise above the things you believe to be true about yourself in your childhood. And that's really Elsa's journey in this book, to go from someone who has no self-esteem and doesn't feel good about herself to realizing that, you know, she's kind of a warrior, that she's willing to stand up for herself and her children and for people who are too afraid to speak for themselves. And I just loved watching that character grow into who she became and find her voice.
So how do you want to tell this? You must have your pitch all at this point in your life. I just want to mention to people, Kristen is a former or a recovering or one of those horrible things called a lawyer. And she's well trained in organizing, and she knows how to put on a defense. And I'm sure that you have a pitch that is all set. How much you want to tell about your story?
Gosh, you'd think I would have this memorized by now.
Yeah, do you want to tell? I mean, I don't want to tell that. Like, for example, I know it starts as she's a girl. Okay, people. Something's going to happen to her. She's going to meet some men along the way. I don't want them to know what's going to happen. I mean, I don't want them to know what's going to happen with that first man in her life. And I don't want her to know, people to know if she ever gets married or not. I want them to live in suspense like I did. You know, I'm reading this book and I don't know what's going to happen. And that was part of the excitement at the beginning. I mean, I sort of thought she might take a different route, actually, with that. Well, I will say, with that red dress, I was worried about her. I said to myself, oh, boy, where am I headed? I am headed to New York City, and I'm not, you know. I wasn't sure she's going to land up in Broadway. You know, you don't know, you know, unless you read all the blurbs on you know, that they put out there and sort of spoilers. But it is a story, knowing you, it has to be about a woman overcoming something, and she overcomes.
Yeah, so I do tend to focus on, you know, women fighting for survival, both physically and emotionally. I mean, then that's very much this book. You know, it's really, I think I guess what we can say is that, you know, it's about a woman on the Great Plains, in the Great Depression, on a failing farm, who has to sort of ultimately decide to either stay on the farm where things are terrible, or, you know, take her children west by herself, which she's been told is the land of milk and honey and advertisements and et cetera. And does she go west and hope for a better life? And if she does she find it?
And it's all set there in, well, she's in Texas. And, of course, any I don't know if they actually use the Grapes of Wrath in school anymore to terrorize children.
That's funny.
Well, the way they present books in school does not make it for fun reading. And I actually had an aversion to this book primarily because I had an aversion to my teacher. I will explain that. I was reading from a very young age, so I was way advanced compared to anybody else. I was way advanced compared to all my teachers. I found it irritating, actually. But for most people, that's what they know about that Dust Bowl. They know that. They might, and if they watch TCM, they've seen the movie. But it was much bigger. And you've done, as a lawyer, you've done massive research into it. Explain, so people can see the parallels to today. This was a major disaster.
Well, yeah, the Dust Bowl was, and I think it remains the greatest environmental disaster in American history. Basically what happened was the Great Plains, after, I guess, World War I became such a breadbasket that farmers plowed up and planted wheat, but without irrigation. And so mid-30s, during the Great Depression, a drought started. And that drought lasted for 4 years. And there was no longer any buffalo grass to keep the soil in place. So as the wind moved across the Great Plains, it picked up dust and created these incredible dust storms that you can actually see in the Ken Burns documentary, a lot of the photos, of the time. And as a girl from the West, I was just shocked. I didn't know about this. And so it just struck me as something that was really relevant today because, here's an issue that man both helped create and helped solve by, changed farming methods. And so I just thought it was really relevant.
And how many people were affected? What was the, there were so many millions of people here were affected by this Dust Bowl.
Oh yeah, it was particularly bad in a certain segment of Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Colorado. That's where it was the real heart of the Dust Bowl. And the fascinating thing to me was, as this went on year after year with the drought and the dust, and the difficulties that came from that, these American farmers for the most part stayed. They stayed on their farms and they kept believing in and hoping for a better future. And then FDR came in and his experts helped them begin to start contouring the land and start making some changes in how they were farming. And I just found, the resilience and the grit, not to make a joke about it, but their strength was so inspirational to me. This reminder of the greatest generation and why we look at them the way we do. They just, were tough and they hung on.
And as you write it with this story, what I want to tell people is Kristen gets you sort of into this story so beautifully, telling the story from about Elsa and then everybody around her. And much of it is heartbreaking because it was very difficult. Today people are facing the problems with the pandemic and we're stuck in the house and people think that that's a terrible thing, but there where they really were trying to eke out a living or life with so little, And of course, in the story, we will say that they head west, and you know, California wasn't very welcoming, and the people along the way weren't very welcoming to these poor people who were suffering.
Yeah, I mean, that's another sadness and another thing, I think, for all of us to keep in mind. You know, we tend to decide that people are the other and that they threaten our way of life. And that's what they found in California, even though they were Americans. And, you know, to be fair to California, they're coming west at a time when there already are no jobs, where there already are, you know, a crumbling of the system because of the Great Depression. So it was a very, very difficult time for the state and for the people who live there, as well as for the migrants coming in who, you know, expected and had a right to expect better.
Well, one of the questions, I don't know if it came through any of your research, why didn't they head north? Why did they head? They head to California because it was because of the advertisements, because of Hollywood, because of the dreams that Hollywood put out there. Because if they would have headed north, you know, I'm from northern Michigan, where we had my grandfather's farm. And thinking back on that, and I know that they didn't suffer the same thing. And I always wondered why these farmers didn't head north. But probably my grandfather would have gotten mad at it. I don't know. But there was plenty of land up there. We still have that same land. We still have that 40 acres. Actually, we have 80 acres. But it's the same land. I've always wondered, you know, I think it probably was the movies that enticed them sort of in that direction, and still does today.
Well, actually, you know, of course, a lot of them did go north. A lot of them did go to Washington and Oregon and all of that. But I think the biggest factor was that a few years prior to this time period, they had deported a lot of the farm workers. There had been sort of a rising up in California, and they had deported a lot of the immigrant farm workers. And so the farmers, the big farmers in the San Joaquin and Valley, they needed workers. And so what they did was they sent out advertisements and postcards to, you know, people who came from other agricultural states, saying basically, this is a land of milk and honey. There's, you know, money to be found on the streets and jobs to be found for everyone.
Uh-huh.
And they just so overshot that, you know, people poured in. No one expected the Great Depression to hit. And so people poured in following these advertisements because they had already been farm workers.
Now, for you, this research must have been fascinating. When you write a book, of course, you take a year or more, perhaps, to do research. What was that like for you? How did you go about it?
This is a really great and fascinating research for me. And yeah, it took about a year to do, you know, what I needed to do to learn about these three, you know, times in America, and a fair amount of travel to the various places. And the way I do it is I sort of begin with the broadest idea of, you know, the Great Depression, and then sort of begin narrowing it down to exactly what story I want to tell. And, you know, when I came to the Dust Bowl and the memoir descriptions of what it was like, I just felt that this was a story that not only needed to be told, but that I wanted to put a woman at the center of. Because, you know, so much of history and what we know of it is from the male perspective. And so, you know, everybody, what most people know of the migrant experience in California in this era is the Grapes of Wrath. And I really wanted to sort of show what it was like for women and women with children. And so, you know, I just started researching. And California has some really great resources. In fact, the weed patch migrant camp that John Steinbeck used is still in Arvin. There are still some buildings there, and you can go check those out. And for a long time, I don't know if they still have it, but they had Dust Bowl Day celebration in October there, and that would bring in a lot of people who, you know, had stories to tell or remembered or lived through the era, and that was a great resource.
Well, the way that you write, you know, you have this voice that you've developed for women's fiction. And in a way, I sometimes hesitate to say women's fiction, because I know that, you know, like we're talking about Steinbeck, or and of course he's under American literature. If you search Amazon, you write American literature, you get John Steinbeck. But I don't know if they search American literature if they get you. But you certainly have gone beyond, to me, you've gone beyond women's literature, you know, if we got to limit it to that, because you are American literature. And I think there's a you know, this greatness in your writing that surpasses simply women's literature.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, it's always difficult in everything, you know, it's easy to be sort of categorized as something for or about women and set to one side or another because of that. But I think I've been really lucky, basically, especially since The Nightingale, which is taught in a lot of classrooms now and is, you know, is really, really got a lot of recognition for, I guess, a piece of writing about an era. And I think that it is possible, you know, to write about women and still be great fiction.
Absolutely, can still be great fiction. I mean, we don't want to get to the point where we'll say, oh, men can write men's fiction, women can write women's fiction. And I think it comes partly from me living overseas for so long that I imagine, and I know, of course, many people in Europe, and I think to myself, well, if they're looking up, you know, on their version of Amazon, on which is, you know, in their language, Amazon, and they're looking up American literature, I want your name to pop up there. I want you to be up there with John Steinbeck. I don't want that, you know, because most Europeans or Asians, they wouldn't type in women's literature. If they wrote in thing, they'd write American literature. And so it's just something, it sort of hit me as I was reading this book. I was thinking, yeah, I know she's number one. I mean, she is the gold standard now. I'm creating her as the gold standard. And of course, you know, with all the women writers that I talk to, they hold you up as, you know, could we be like, just, you know, I mean, when you heard that they were doing a run of, like, they're, you know, doing 1.5 million books, like, do you, like, get really excited still? Or is The Nightingale sort of jaded you?
No, I still get really excited. You know, it's exciting. I mean, honestly, you know, it's a level of sort of visibility that I never even really dreamed of or imagined. And, you know, people always wonder sort of if it's changed my life or, you know, how much difference it makes. And, you know, the truth is that I still do what I love. You know, I've been writing books for a long time. I am absolutely passionate about it. I love reading. I love writing. I like writing stories that have real emotional resonance, that stick with you, and that hopefully teach and inspire you. And, you know, soon when, you know, it will be time for me to go back to the real world and just sit down with my yellow legal pad and start writing again.
And I'm sure you are busy at that. But the funny thing is, I just... I get such a kick out of the people, my listeners, who, you know, first, of course, as I said, many wrote in about me talking to you today. But during this pandemic-y time, I have been, of course, encouraging people. I always encourage people to write a book. And so many people have started, and especially women, have started writing books during this pandemic time. And I've already received, I started receiving somewhere around, you know, the pandemic was started in March and April, May, and somewhere in September, the end of September, I got a first sort of email from somebody, and she said, "I finished my book. I'm ready. How do I do my query letter?" And I thought, okay, I think I have to take a step back. And so then after that, actually, I started doing programs, talking to people about there is a process here. You don't like type the last, you know, the last word in on your computer and then start doing the query. I said, you know, like, there's a little process here of editing. And how many times did you edit it yourself? So tell us, how much fun was it when you finished your very first book? Did you get out there and get yourself a query letter and an agent and a six-figure deal on your very first book?
Yeah, not so much. And you know what's interesting to your readers, just as a quick little parallel, I started writing my first novel when I was bedridden and pregnant with my son. So I was basically mostly in the hospital, and but always in bed. I couldn't, you know, get out a whole lot for 6 months. And that's when I started writing, which feels in a way, you know, like the pandemic, this idea that I'm going to use this time, which has been thrust upon me, to do something that I have dreamed of that otherwise I never would have, you know, sort of probably found the time to do. And so I did write my first novel in that 6 months, and I did send it out to one lucky editor, and I learned very quickly that I wasn't good enough. You know, I mean, because, yeah, that's the dream. You sit down, you write it, you're a genius, and they recognize your genius, and you're off to the races. But the truth is that, you know, it's a long process about essentially finding your voice and learning how to be good at something, kind of an apprenticeship or college kind of experience. And, you know, the key is, I think that if you have readers who, I mean, viewer listeners who are dreaming about this, the key is sit down and write and keep writing and learn how to do it and, you know, be durable. You have to, like in all the arts, you have to push through negative remarks, negative comments, people who will laugh that you're trying it. And just, you know, keep believing in yourself and keep working at it, because it is something that you can learn to do if you're sort of disciplined and passionate and determined.
And the word is passion. You have to have a passion for writing that you'd write even if you didn't get paid, because you have to love it.
Yep.
But, you know, people think, for example, you know, now that you're so big and so important, you probably just sit, you know, we talked about that first paragraph didn't come immediately, but people still imagine that you just sort of type it up and that's it, and print it, and you know, you send it to your editor. There is still an editing process, even for you at your right.
Not only is there an editing process, but I think what's important is there's also fear. You know, I have written 24 books. And I was just talking to Ellen Hildebrand about this the other day, another really successful female novelist. And, you know, we still begin every book afraid that we're not going to be able to do it again. And the difference is that you, like I think in anything that you really care about, you just harness that fear, you put it aside, and you keep going. And, you know, you keep writing. And because we know that you can fix a bad page and you can make something better, but you can't fix nothing. And writing is one of those things that you can't think or dream your way into. You have to write your way through it, and you have to do it, you know, one paragraph at a time.
And one sentence at a time, which sometimes you have to rewrite a few times. That has happened to you, right?
Oh, I write, you know, there's probably 17 different versions of The Four Winds on my computer right now. I do huge revision, sweeping revision, both at, you know, sort of a micro and a macro level. I really love the process of polishing words and sentences into the best story that they can be, because that's really what I do. I give people characters to root for and a story that hopefully once they begin, they can't stop reading.
Well, it's, you know, as I'm reading the book, I'm thinking, because I know I'm going to be talking to you, I was thinking, oh, you know, I love this section. I love the red dress. I love the beauty shop segment. Oh. I looked at that. I read it. Of course, I was reading it. But then, knowing I'm going to talk to you, I went back and I reread it. And I thought, wow, the way you did that segment, it's not big. It's not, you know, it's not a major portion. It's just a few pages. But it is so well written. And I was thinking, did she write that just exactly like that? Or did she have to go back? but it's very well done.
You know, the interesting thing about that is one of my favorite scenes in the whole book as well.
Oh.
And in the three and a half years that I was working on this book and writing versions of it and starting over, that scene didn't occur until the very last editing version. So it was like almost at the very end, I almost didn't find it. And so it's a great reminder that you just keep fixing, you just keep rewriting and looking for, again, the best story.
Well,
you end up with this magic.
I think for many people, they'll read the book, they'll remember a lot of the scenes, but I think for many people, Betty Ann and her husband will stick in their minds, and you will think about it. You will think about it when you go to a beauty salon. You'll think about that scene, and it's only a few pages, but so beautifully written. Wow. I thought it was fantastic.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm really glad you loved the novel.
Well, you know, it's always an honor to talk to you. You know, I love talking to authors. What I try to do on this program, I have a wide variety. I'm an eclectic reader, and so I have people who are just starting off, people whose books aren't, you know, they've self-published, but they're trying, and it's exciting. And one of the things I want to mention, another important element in your book is libraries, because a library changed my life. As I said, I came from northern Michigan, and when I was young, in second grade, we were forced, actually, because of a sort of mini depression, we went to Detroit to live. And I found one of those wonderful, wonderful libraries, you know, those big old libraries that they built. And it changed my life. And so in your book, you have quite a few library segments that are fascinating.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, books are so important, I think. And it's very much, you know, sort of a theme in this book. From the very, you know, beginning, Elsa's life is changed by reading The Age of Innocence and making changes to her own life because of the way the novel, you know, makes her feel. And she passes along to her children, no matter how difficult times are, no matter how little money they have, the library is always there. And, you know, through books, we can not only experience other lives and better lives, but we can also, you know, educate ourselves. And there's a great scene in the novel with a library card. And to me, it's just so important to talk about books in that kind of way, because they are so important in my own life.
Well,
and, you know, one of the first things I did with my son was, you know, begin reading to him. And now he has a love of books, which he is passing on to his young daughter. And it's just a wonderful, thing that brings us all together.
Well, a library card is a card to magic. It opens up the world, which is why I sort of became a world traveler, because of all the books that I read when I was a little girl in that wonderful McGregor Public Library in Detroit, Michigan. And I was so fortunate that you know I got there. And I hope that, unfortunately, our kids today, I don't know what they're going through. Can't go to the libraries, can't go here, can't go there. We look back on it, and our childhoods were so much more fun. But I hope that, a lot of people are going to be reading this book, and I think that will be one of the things that they will take away, the importance of going to the library.
I hope so as well. Definitely.
Well, you know, I couldn't read all the things that you are. You know, you have so many, now people say so many wonderful things about you. And it's just, all I can say is that by now announcing that you are the gold standard, I hope that people will just take that in mind. And of course, with selling 1.5 million books in overnight, I think probably overnight. You could probably buy yourself a gold crown too, and when you can start doing book events again, oh my goodness, the day will come, I hope.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, you have a website you want people to go to, and what do you have on that website? Oh, club stuff.
Pretty much everything is, you know, on kristenhanna.com, and I'm pretty active on my Facebook and Instagram pages, and they're doing a lot of fun stuff right now for the Netflix Firefly Lane series, which people are loving. So I love to hear from readers, and they can just reach me on any of those areas and get all the information they need.
Well, Kristen, it's wonderful, wonderful to talk to you again. I think you are just delightful. Your books are just pure, great American literature.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great talking to you also.
Oh, and thanks for giving me so much of your very precious time, because I know you are in demand, and it's been a thrill to have you back on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you so much. It's been great. Have a good rest of the week.
Okay, and you too. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Woo! What an author. Well, people, okay, 24 books later, and this first run, her first run, and it's funny, I love it. You know, I get these early editions before anybody else. I get the, you know, I've had this book for 6 months, and it's very exciting. But when you have a first run of 1.5 million books, which are pre-sold, they're pre-sold. Those ones are already sold. They just sent them out on day one, and today is her pub date. So this is pretty exciting. And the book, I'm not going to tell you the whole story. You have to get it yourself. And I'm sure that all of you out there will find, you know, these are difficult times. And in a way, I am sort of more reading, not trying to read more funny books lately. Because I'm getting a little bit, I'm not saying I'm going Looney Tunes, but I'm getting a little bit cuckoo. But, you know, still, Kristen Hanna, you will enjoy the process of reading this book, and it's fascinating. Wow. I don't know what's going on in the world. As a matter of fact, I actually don't know what's going on in the world, because I can't turn on the news. The only news I ever see now is when I come in the studio and Big Ed in the control room has the news on. And that's probably the only news, or the top of the hour news, that I can take, because I have to, you know, I really want to tell people, I hope that all of you won't be writing just pandemic-y books in the future. And if I get too many books with people wearing masks, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to start reviewing comic books, because I just can't take it. It's getting a little, and I'm telling you, that person, and I know you, actually, I know you listen to me. This person who wrote me this pandemic book with about a new pandemic of yellow leprosy, which does not exist. I'm telling you, it does not exist. I did not appreciate that, because I didn't know it was going to be about that. And ever since I read that book, I had it in my head, and I cannot stand it. So you have to be careful what you're writing. Anyway, it's wonderful. I'm going to have on this week, my goodness, Lang Martin Jr. and Holly Woolbright are going to be on, and we're going to be celebrating here. We're going to be celebrating what? What are we going to be celebrating? I don't know. We're celebrating something. Oh, Valentine's Day. You see, this is what I'm saying. I don't know what I am anymore. It's almost the middle of February. Can you believe it? The whole year's gone so fast already. And I told you at the beginning of the year to start writing your book. And I hope that perhaps Christine Hanna has inspired you. And perhaps it'll take you 30 years. I don't know. But if she could do it, why not you? It's up to you. You have to it's a combination of being passionate and being absolutely dedicated to the process. Now, I happen to know that she writes a lot of words a day, but that's because she sets herself a goal. And even if she has only 40 minutes, she will type like crazy and write like crazy in 40 minutes. It's all a matter of organizing. Because remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or a major I already said major motion picture. It'll be, what the heck, it'll be a series on the Hallmark Channel, or as Kristen has now on Netflix. So you never know, and you won't know unless you start writing, because that's part of the absolute, one of the best and wonderful things that you can do in life, and it is a pure joy to see your words. And I hope that all of you will get working this weekend and read a good book. You can't go to the library, but you can order them, and order a great book, and then just say something nice to somebody today. And I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed, for everything. I drive him crazy sometimes, but I love him. And I hope that you all have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And all of you people up north who are having negative 17 degrees weather, like my brother did this morning, I just feel sorry for you. Come down to Florida. Bye-bye now.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
WZHR Zephyr Hills
FM 104.3
Listen.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Rocket Mortgage.
I'm Steve Kathan. For the first time in U.S. history, a former president is about to go on trial in the U.S. Senate. Donald Trump impeached for inciting an insurrection. CBS's Nicole Killian.
House impeachment managers, who have been meeting daily, plan to use video evidence.